Digital rights management, and it's an interesting application of cryptography. Let me just sort of explain my background. Although it says digital rights management, what I'm really interested in is distributed security. And what you can imagine, only barely, doing computer security with no cryptography on a machine in a locked room that people log onto with passwords, it's very, very hard to imagine doing manageable distributed security without cryptography. And you'll see how the DRM model is actually not a bad model for how you might do distributed security. So, but let's go back to its historical roots. The original argument was that digital objects are very easy and cheap to copy, music, books, text, executables. So there's essentially no friction. Once somebody's gotten the book in digital form or the movie or the music, they can post it on a website, you can download it. There's essentially no copying cost. On the other hand, it's a great distribution system. So if you can manage to get paid for something you could distribute for cost zero, it would be a good deal. So that's sort of the historical, what I call big rights management motivation. I'm going to focus on this talk about how you might protect digital content, and then sort of lead into distributed security. There are other questions like, should you digital content be protected? There's lots of there's lots of contrasting public policy and commercial reasons why you may or may not want to use DRM. I actually find most of them, DRM is just another tool. Copyright law is evolving. It's hard to get too religious about either side of this argument. Copyright law has tried to strike a balance, and that law has changed in both ways, so there just may need to be a new set of laws. Can digital content be protected? Well, sort of yes and no. In the end, digital content, as any content, is you hear it in your ear. There's a transducer, and you can always tape it and then digitize it later. So there's some sense it's almost impossible to protect mass market. Lots of people have access to, or even 65,536 people get access to the content. On the other hand, again, the model for DRM is not so much a security one, but can I get paid? So even with bad DRM systems, people argue they don't have to be great, they just have to be so I get money on Gone with the Wind or whatever I'm trying to protect. Okay, persistent pirate will always be able to get generally available content. And so in addition to DRM, if you wanted to protect content, you actually have to stop distribution of illegal content. So if you ever are in that business, you need to know that. Okay. So let's go back to computer security. Computer security involves processes and technology that enable enforcement of a security policy on a computer. And security policy specifies a bunch of things, a bunch of safety properties, how isolated this thing I'm about to do safe is from other things. And it also names access rights. That user logged on to that machine can read that file. Interestingly, the rights are not, the restrictions are not persistence. Once I've let you read a file, you can copy the file anywhere you want. It's no longer protected. DRM is a little bit different from that. Digital rights management also involves enforcement of security policy, but it's supposed to persist with the content in some sense. And that's the trick of how to do it. The standard model for computer security is you have a user processor sitting in user space. This is the non-distributed security model, which some people will get away from someday, but it seems to be burned into their minds. The user space is where the untrusted processes sit. Each user is isolated from every other user, but all the resources are protected by this one super trusted thing, the operating system, which contains a trusted computing base, which has a reference monitor, which gates all access to files, for example, as a resource. DRM is a little bit different. The super administrator that's universally trusted doesn't exist, right? The whole point of me DRM protecting something that you could read on your machine, you're the administrator of that machine, I still don't want you to be able to copy it. So the root of trust has all changed. The model is naturally distributed. If I can figure out a way to protect my stuff on your machine, I've got a great distributed security model if it really works well. The persistent rights, these rights are supposed to be, he should be able to read, watch the movie I gave him offline, even when he's no longer connected to me. If I give him rights, he should be able to do it offline. And I'm going to have very granular rights. For example, I may say he can watch the movie between 9 and 12, but not after that, for some reason. So the rights that are conveyed are can be quite a bit richer than the read, write, execute writes you're accustomed to in normal security. The only way to do this really is cryptographic protection. And it only runs in an environment where the thing displaying, the thing that gets unencrypted bits is trusted in some ways, which means you have to be able to authenticate software, and software has to have secrets which are not discoverable by other software. It also means you have to have a good isolation model so that other software and the operating system and the administrator of the machine can't look into that that box that's really protected against all that stuff. And you should do this in a way which is not scary. Right? If I send him a piece of software on his machine that does that, he better be pretty sure my software's not going to do anything bad on his machine because he's lost control at that point. Okay, there are two elements of DRM that correspond well to the two elements of standard computer security policy. One is called licensing, which computer scientists in the standard model call authorization. When I say I'm granting access to Benelo to read this file, that's an authorization decision I make. And the second is enforcement. When Benelo goes to get the file, the operating system's going to check that it's Benelo and see that he has read access. And DRM also has the two elements of security, licensing and enforcement. But the way it does protection is using encryption and integrity-protected rules and sealed keys. So here's how you protect. Here's the two-minute lesson on how you protect something with DRM in sort of a straightforward way. First of all, you encrypt the content, typically with a symmetric key because you want the decryption to be fast. So it's unusable unless somebody has the key that was used to encrypt it.
That'd be unusable without the write then?
It's right now, unless I give you the way to decrypt it, you can have all the rights in the world. If you can't get the key, you can't get the content. That's
Michael,
it.
Sorry. Invisible without the right.
Oh, the right to decrypt. Okay, without the ability to decrypt, which means the key. Okay, so what you do is you first encrypt the content, you have a key in your hand. Now I want to make sure that that key can only be used by trusted software in a trusted environment, and that trusted software will listen to a bunch of rules I've given it about the use of that content. So what I do is I take that content key, encrypt it with the public key of a trusted environment, an environment I have sitting on his machine. I embed that in a license which says how you can read all this stuff, you know, what are the conditions under which you can read it, like it's midnight to 3 a.m. or whatever the conditions are, 3 days, whatever. And let's forget about secure clocks and all that. And then I sign the license so he can't change it, so nobody can change it. Okay? So I'm simplifying this. You can do something much more general, but basically a content license may look something like this. Machine 0345 running program number 1 with this cryptographic hash can view document 332 on that date. And there's a sealed key there, signed Boeing. Okay. On the other end, I better have a program which knows Boeing's public key, which can A, verify the signature, B, check all the rules apply, and then C, decrypt that content key. Once I've decrypted the content key, I'm off and running. It also has to be isolated from everything else on the machine, because once I've decrypted the content, it's available to anybody, so it should stay within the boundary of that trusted application. Yes?
How do you know the hash is valid?
That's a policy decision. So typically, let's just go to the big digital rights story. I'm a studio trying to protect the content. Microsoft and 4 other companies say, here's our program, here's this cryptographic hash, you can trust that we did the right thing here. So that's one way to do it. In practice, it's quite a hard problem because you'd like to trust programs that you're sure will do the right thing. And any significant size program, there are bugs in it, there's all kinds of stuff. So it's a difficult problem in practice. But again, we're talking about good enough protection so that, you know, it's supposed to be the rough equivalent of I can't go to the movie and take a video camera.
You have no way of verifying the hash, right?
No, you do.
Over the machine.
No. So all I'm doing, all this is, I haven't gone to the enforcement stage. This says, if for some way you can actually verify the hash of a program, this is the program I trust. I haven't told you how to do securely verify the trust yet. And in fact, the way I'm going to tell you how to do it involves some hardware. So So, okay. Then when you do enforcement, it's actually quite easy. So you have this trusted application. The trusted application says to someone, let's say it's the hardware for a minute, isolate me. Don't let anybody look at my address space. The second thing it says is authenticate me. Take my cryptographic hash. The third thing it says is, now that you know my cryptographic hash, you have a key squirreled away in the hardware that's only available to the software with this cryptographic hash. Give it to me now. Okay? And then when I get this trusted content, I'm sorry, this is probably untrusted content, this protected content, I get a license for the content that states all those conditions and has the sealed key. I authenticate the license by checking the signature. And again, on this trusted program, I have the key of Boeing in the earlier case in it. So I'm going to check that that's really a valid license. I'm going to check all the conditions apply that I can actually play this content right now. I'm going to use my private key now to decrypt the sealed content key, which the guy who licensed it to me only needs to know the public key to seal it to me, right? And then I play the content. And I make sure I obey the rules. So if I'm a trusted program, I make sure you can't, if it's text, you can't copy it. If it's a video, I make sure you can't send the unencrypted video to a file, because then you can do whatever you want with it after that. So I'm a trusted program. That's how I work.
So Jeff's PC has the private key but can't look at it?
So Jeff's PC, imagine in this simple model, and I'll tell you how might this work in practice, but the simple model is Jeff's PC has a private key which it will only give to a program with that hash. So it's physically, again, the key is physically in my presence somehow, but I can't get at it. Yeah?
And how does the key store prevent somebody just calling that API and providing a hash value that's not?
Because a trusted program or the hardware watched the program get loaded in and took its cryptographic hash. It didn't say, oh, here's my cryptographic hash, why don't you give me my key? It wasn't that. It had to watch the thing load.
So this is still susceptible to malformed drivers.
Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. Yeah, so with current operating systems and current hardware, this is very peccable. Not impeccable. There's lots of ways to break this. And none of them involve breaking in cryptography.
Right.
Just stay away from that. So to obtain a license, to obtain this content, it's also a very easy distributed problem. You don't have a lot of, it's not the sort of domain-based, everybody has to trust each other or a trust administrator. Your machine comes with a certificate that names its public key. That's the public key that content key is going to get sealed to. When you want to get a piece of content, you call up the content owner on the internet, say, here's my certificate, it's a trusted machine. Why don't you go to your database and check that it was signed by somebody you trust not to have, basically to have made this private key available only for trusted software. You go do that, you can do that by checking your database, checking your policy. And when you've done that and I pay my money, why don't you make me up one of these nice content licenses with the sealed symmetric key in it? And that's how you obtain content. Totally distributed. And again, just keep in mind, I keep on referring to this as digital rights. This could be any file. Anything, any bunch of bits you want to get access to, you can do it this way. And that means you can use them once they're offline. It's pretty safe. It's a nice, manageable, distributed model. And unlike 50 billion ACLs on your machine, to verify the security aspect, all you have to do is look at locally, this set of licenses. And in fact, these licenses can all be presented at once. You can even separate the findings, the policy from enforcing the policy. Nice simple model, small trusted computing base, blah, 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 blah. So this would all, I hear many of you say, oh, that did work out pretty well. This sounds like a great idea, but I've written software before. You can't hide private keys on a machine. Who are you trying to lie? And that's actually generally true. That's the problem with many DRM systems now. So let me tell you a model which wasn't specifically to protect movie content, but here's a model for how you can do this in software. And it relies on four hardware capabilities that machines are about to have. Some of them have them. And we'll see more of that in the future. First is something that costs strong process isolation. The very first thing you need to do is you need to be able to isolate a trusted lump of software from everything else on the machine. That means, in principle, on machines you're used to, the operating system can't look into the address space. Nothing can look into the address space of this isolated process. The second thing you need is sealed storage. That's the ability to seal a key, to have the hardware seal a key for a piece of software and only make it available to that piece of software. And in order to make it available to that software, I'll tell you how a system like this would boot, and you'll see how these elements are all connected. The third thing you need is a secure path to the user. So now forget about DRM for a second. Suppose you use a mechanism like this to protect a banking application. Okay, this is your the way you interact with your bank. You can use this entire mechanism that I just told you to have a very secure application. Only your user keys are available in that trusted application, blah, 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 blah. It doesn't do you much good if another program can fool the user into typing his password or typing whatever information he typed to the bank to get it to do what you want, right? So in addition to these three things, you have to have a secure path to the user, and that typically means keyboard, screen, and mouse. Nothing else. Everything else is protected cryptographically. You don't care whether the disk can be looked at by somebody else, but you want for sure the hardware to make sure that the thing the trusted program says this is coming from me is the thing coming from it. And the final thing you need is this attestation. And that's the ability for me on my machine to send you a message that says, here's a bit of data. It comes from the program with this cryptographic hash, sign the hardware. Attestation lets you negotiate keys. So let's say I tell you I'm about to run my trusted instant messaging program. And so the way it works is I give, and you trust the guy who wrote the program. I send him a copy of the program. I have a copy of the program. Our two programs talk to each other. And they say, hey, listen, we want to negotiate a private key so nobody else can say it. First, can you make up a public-private key pair over there and send me a statement with the public key that was signed by this trusted software, me in this case, that I trust, signed, blah, blah, blah. So now I can negotiate public keys without a PKI. These two programs, because they trust each other, can negotiate a public key. Now they can open up secure channel, exchange more keys, exchange content, do whatever they want. And both sides of that operation can be sure, even if he's a crummy machine administrator, even if he puts the worst possible software on his machine, I don't really need to rely on that. I'm not relying on that when I talk that instant messaging program, because that program is isolated from all that other junk. And the only program that's going to see the content I type to it is that trusted program, and it's not going to leak it to anybody. So that's another thing. So these are the four mechanisms. Let me explain how they might work. Here's how a trusted operating system, and typically you would boot a small operating system that typically you would boot a hypervisor. Here's how it works. When the program, the trusted operating system gets loaded into physical memory, and there's a new set of instructions which do the following things atomically. They say, transfer control to the top of this program that's just about to run. Isolate this memory region. This is done atomically by the hardware. Take a cryptographic hash of everything in that region. Stick it in a special unwritable location. Turn the interrupts off. Let the thing initialize itself the way it ever wants. And go. Okay? And now the hardware knows the cryptographic hash of the thing it boots. If I want to store something securely, I call a hardware call that says, here's a bit of binary data, please save this for me. And what the hardware does is it takes the cryptographic hash, which it has in its unwritable memory, appends the data to it, encrypts it with a key it has, in this case it can be a symmetric key, and gives it back to me. Now, whenever I run that program again and I want that data, I hand it to the hardware and say, please decrypt this for me. And the hardware says, decrypts it. It says, is this the cryptographic hash of the program that I stored this for? If the answer is yes, it gets it back to me. If the answer is no, it doesn't. Okay? The CryptAt mechanism, since I've booted securely, any request to sign something, to attest to something from the program, the hardware automatically append the cryptographic hash of the thing running. So it lets you do attestation easily. Okay. And actually, with that, you can build an actually reasonably safe DRM system. The actual, probably the best way to do it is the following. I don't know how many of you are systems guys. Can I write on this? I guess I can. What you'd really do is you build a small hypervisor, the small operating system. It's, you want it to be small because the bigger it is, the more chance you did to blow something. That operating system only controls a few things. It controls memory, controls CPU allocation, it controls the chip that watches the boot of the secure operating system called the TPM chip. And it controls device assignment, but it doesn't have any drivers in it except possibly the keyboard driver and the screen buffer. Okay, so you boot the secure operating system, and it has keys. And what it does is the same thing computer scientists have done for the last 50 years. If you have something that works in one level, you virtualize it for the next level. So this hypervisor will store keys and attest for the operating systems. The operating systems will store keys and attest for their applications. So you have a nice, safe system. And if you wanted to do DRM with this hardware, what you basically do is you build a small trusted OS that didn't have too much crap in it, and the DRM application, the thing you were using to display the content, a secure Adobe Reader or an MP3 player or whatever. What's our media player? Media player. That's what that media player is. Whatever the thing is that, and you make sure that's safe. And they basically just go through this dance I explained to you with the DRM system. They have the application has a code identity. It has secrets stored for it. It can prove to somebody on the outside it's who it says it is. DRM works fine. And incidentally, not only does it work fine, you have a nice manageable security infrastructure for just about anything. Any content you want to protect, you can basically encrypt it, send it to your 50 million best friends. They can be your storage thing. And when you want it, just go get it back. As long as you hold the keys and the content licenses, you're golden. Get whatever you want. So I actually prefer it as a general security system than a DRM system, but that is how it works. Now, in order to do this in a really flexible way, in addition, can I finish this one slide and then you can ask? I've told you, you've learned all the cryptographic mechanisms you need to learn to build such a system. You've learned about cryptographic caches to identify the application, the software. You've learned about public key encryption so that you can seal a key for me, but only I can unseal it. You learned about symmetric key functions. You learned all the cryptography. In addition to that, you have to have a sort of a universally understandable way to communicate the rights I'm going to give you, like read rights, or you can play between 9 and 12. So you have to have some kind of rights language, just generally interoperable rights language. This is one. It doesn't matter what you use, really. Okay. So I've talked about it's easier to motivate DRM in this, Hollywood wants to sell you their latest movie scenario. But I actually think another application of DRM, and probably a better suited application, is what I call small rights management. If I want to protect personal information, health information, financial information, or corporate information, all that information is stuff I want to keep secret, but I am naturally going to want to share it with some people on the outside in a selected way. And I'm never, ever, ever, because I went to Josh's class 2 years ago, going to trust them to manage their machine the right way, ever. They're going to blow it. They're going to give away my personal information if I don't have some technical reason to believe they're going to use it right. And so I can protect that information with the DRM. So, for example, if I wanted to, Amazon keeps a list of all the books I buy from them. And whenever I buy a book, they said, "Hey, John, glad to see you again, you sucker. I've noticed these other books you bought in the past. We just found these three other books that you'll really love." And it's actually a great thing. I buy them half the time, at least. But Amazon knows every book I buy. And I may not think that's such a red-hot idea that they give it to anybody in the world. It turns out they're mostly math books, so it's okay.
Buy spurious books and inject noise in the system?
No, I don't do that.
Those kind of books are what set off the most red flags.
Yeah, that's probably right. But here's what I could do. I could protect that information. I could say, Amazon, you don't get to keep that information. I'm only going to talk to a trusted program, which I can authenticate using this attestation mechanism. I'm never going to release the content until I check that the program over there is the one I expect, and I check that it will obey my policy. Then I'll give you the information. Do whatever you, do the things you're allowed to do with it. Recommend new books for me. I'm happy if you do that. But you can never write that information outside the boundary of that trusted application unencrypted. You can never, ever have it. You can use it for me, just like health information, but you can't keep it. So I actually think that's a more useful application. So you could, there's lots of systems. One of the ones I designed is called, I designed, and some other people in the room have helped with, is called RMS, that we use to protect emails. So again, emails is an interesting application. You may want to send somebody an email, but you may not want them to forward it. You know, I might send Brian an email that says, you know, that Josh is a nice guy, but he screws up all the time, and I don't want him to forward that to Josh. Once I've sent him that email, if he can copy and paste it or forward it, I'm done. Josh is going to see it. But if I RM protect it, again, if I had a reasonable enforcement system on the machine, which you don't, we'll go to part two right now, he really can't forward that. Now, he can always call Josh in his office and say, hey, Josh, look at this jerk John just sent me. But he can't forward it to him.
And you still can't protect against screen scraping.
Yes, well, we'll have a screen scraping thing in a minute. Then there's big rights management. I'm probably a little bit I'm usually on the left wing of most issues, but this I'm a little bit to the right wing of most people. I think it's perfectly okay to use DRM to protect books and audio and video. The real policy question is whether people can impose egregious restrictions on the content. And again, for big rights management, where you're sending it to lots of people, you can't really, really protect it too well. So the question is, can you protect it well enough so you have a business, so that you're willing to produce the book or the movie or the software? And I think it's possible that's a reasonable thing to do. It also, it's possible that could provide great convenience. So for example, when I'm on the road, when I go to Germany next week, I may be sitting there going, that book I have at home, there's this proof of the Chinese remainder theorem, I just can't remember it. And unless I haul all my books with me, all the places I go, I'm not going to do that. But I can imagine a rights management protected version of that would let me see that anywhere I want, that anywhere in the world, and you know, it's just a convenience thing. As it happens, you can look up the Chinese remainder theorem on the web without protection, but the idea is the important thing.
Or you can search within the book on Amazon.
Sometimes you can do that too, yeah. Yes?
Two questions. What happens when we need to service the encryption algorithms because a new attack comes out that are used by the TPM or some other very low-level thing?
Yep.
Are we in trouble?
Yeah, you're in trouble, basically. There are two things. You can afford to put very safe algorithms in the TPM. They haven't. Actually, they use SHA-1 and RSA 2048 for TPMs, which are not bad. And again, just keep in mind, you're not protecting national secrets. You're just, you know. I really only used the TPM crypto twice. Three times, actually, sorry. The crypto in the TPM is used to calculate the cryptographic hash of the thing booted. That's one application. The second application is to decrypt a key, decrypt material for you. And it really only typically does that once. Let's say you've booted a secure operating system. It will go to the TPM once and say, here's a blob with all my keys decrypted for me. You won't use the decryption from the TPM anymore. You'll do that in your isolated environment from then on. And the third thing you do is you might ask it to sign things for you. And again, you would do that very rarely. What you'd really do is say, please sign this new key that I'm going to use to actually talk to people with and convince them that it's okay. And after that, I won't use you. So during the course of a secure session, you'll only use the cryptographic facilities of the TPM a very few times. And we can afford to make that pretty darn safe.
And then, what is that domain zero stuff that you showed?
I'm sorry. This is a larger propaganda issue about what you might want to use secure hypervisors for. So you might want to use it to host legacy operating systems. Because you want the hypervisor to be tiny, as small as possible, think 100,000 lines, you really don't want to do any machine management in that that partition. So typically, you defer all machine management to a little operating system that I call Domain Zero. That does things like assign hardware, assign, you know, format disks, whatever you need to do to manage the machine. You want to keep that away from the itsy-bitsy, tiny, small, trustworthy that everybody in the world has to trust, trusted computing base and the hypervisor. So that's Domain Zero. Yeah?
Just a small question, practicality. How would you enable debugging of the hypervisor and distinguish between developers actually debugging legitimately and somebody trying to hack themselves in?
So it's easy. They, as it turns out, there are two things you can do. The easy thing to do is just you can have So the you can set the chip so that it uses basically it tells the thing this is unprotected. I'm going to make believe it's protected, but it's not. And so don't sign anything with your real keys. And you can encrypt, you know, you can do steel storage, but I'm actually going to tell you the key to use so I can debug normally. And by the way, you know all that stuff about isolating the memory? It was just a joke. For this, well, I'm debugging. So really, the only difference between the trusted application and the debuggable application and the non-debuggable application is the settings when you're booting it. And that's okay. You can run the same software. It just you just have to be sure that it won't do it won't trick somebody into an attestation of the debuggable version of the software. You got to do that. But it won't do that because it won't for some reason you've set up the machine that way. Another thing you can do is depending on how fancy you want to get, you can actually the identity of the software could either be a hash of the whole operating system or it can be a hash of a tiny statement. And the statement can include things like here's the hash of the rest of the thing I want you to protect and some properties. One of the thing properties can be debuggable or not. Because it's a hash of this thing, you can't fool a debuggable version of this into thinking it's not debuggable. So there are a bunch of ways to do it. But the, ultimately, the code, you, when you debug the code, in the debuggable environment and the protected environment, it's precisely the same code. This is the short story. So you just, you, roughly, you turn off the security mechanisms and everything works fine.
So I was just curious if an attacker can use that where, like, they can run their hypervisor.
Because the only thing that's different between the debuggable environment and the undebuggable environment is which keys it gets. And the attacker can never get the keys in the non-debuggable environment. Ever, 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 in principle.
That's the small trusted OS part, would that work for open source OS?
Sure. It's any old hypervisor. I mean, the hardware is supposed to be built so you say what you trust, not me. You just can't lie about it. You can't lie to me. When you said boot this operating system, you can't lie to me about the identity of the operating system, but you say what operating system you're booting, not me. So you can boot anything you want, and it works fine with open source. You can build an open source hypervisor easily. Yeah. Okay, so big rights management, you probably get all the pay-per-view movies, ringtones. As it turns out, ringtones, as I understand it, is the highest revenue DRM application at the moment. I don't quite understand it, but I believe that's the deal. And there you actually do have secure hardware, right? There's a SIM chip in the thing, and you're not supposed to be able to open up your phone. So it contains the key. There are two ways to do trusted, basically a protected environment. The way I just explained to you is the hard way, where you have a general purpose PC, and you're allowed to run any program you want on your PC. You download new hardware, do whatever you want. The easy way to do it is a closed box. I will only let software in the box that I trust as the manufacturer of that device. And cell phones would fall into category two. So, ebooks, I know a company that actually does a fairly good business in library ebooks, roaming ebooks. It's not really caught on generally, but that's it works out well. Actually, I was hoping that was one of my favorite applications because I was deadly serious. Every once in a while, I'll go on a trip, and it's I wish I had that book with me. And what often happens, I just go to a bookstore and buy it again. So by my fourth copy of Serge Lang's algebra book, I'm feeling silly.
So
Have you tried out the King County Library system?
I have not, but the company I know actually does the King County Library DRM system.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's over. I won't say their name. I know the company.
A lot of audiobooks that you can check out.
Yep. Okay, so I'll talk about one. Oh, I'm sorry. So I talked to you about it like this was no joke and that it actually worked. The trouble with the DRM system is most of the hardware isn't there yet. So what happens is people try to protect the keys with software. And that presents a barrier, but not a very big one. Because don't forget, on his machine, he still do you run Windows?
Yeah,
on that puppy.
I've got Linux on it, too.
Okay, that's fine. But either one, he owns the kernel. He can't isolate. I cannot give him, if I give him a program that's software protected, he can put something in the Unix kernel or load a driver in Windows that can get whatever I want, whatever he wants from any one of my user programs. So there's no good isolation model with pure software. And in practice, people even do stupider things. You know, they decrypt the content key and it's paged out on disk. They don't erase it. They leave it for a rainy day somewhere. They have, if you're protecting a Word document, it's really quite likely that there'll be a temporary unencrypted copy of the Word document laying around somewhere. But in principle, you could do a good job and do all that stuff properly if you could protect the keys.
I was going to say, there's a program called Total Recorder that will slip itself into your audio stream, layer, grab any audio.
Yeah. Now, so again, the DRM solution to that is the hardware that the trusted blah, blah, whatever is running it, trusted hypervisor, will assign the audio path to this trusted thing, and you can't stick anything in there. It sticks a driver in there. And in fact, if you want to get really hysterical, you can encrypt audio all the way out to the speakers. You can basically exchange public keys with trusted speakers. I guess it's getting slightly ridiculous, but you could do that. It doesn't stop you from taping that speaker, but... There you go. There was another method which I thought was really ridiculous for protecting content called watermarking. I guess we didn't talk about this. And the idea, it's a clever idea, and I think watermarking has a couple of applications, and I'll tell you one of them I think that it does work well in. But the idea was, we're going to stick, using signal processing, a bit in a content stream that says whether it's protected or not. And we're going to stick it in a way which is not easy to take out. And when I play that content, I'm going to run an application which looks for that bit, and if the bit, don't forget, I haven't encrypted the content, I just have this, it's just watermarked. The player is going to say, oh, I can't possibly play this content unless you get a license for it. Okay, so there are about a billion problems with that. First of all, the easiest way to defeat this is to say, gee, that application is going to look for the watermarking bit. I'll use that application that doesn't look for the watermarking bit and play it just fine. It's usually easy to remove the watermarks, too. I think one interesting application for watermarking is forensics. If you give everybody a different copy, you can track somebody who did a bad thing, especially personal information. And the other one is a purely practical one. If you're on a radio, you're on basically analog device, and you basically want to order the song. You can watermark the song with its whatever they use to mark songs, so its song number, and then you can imagine pressing a button saying I want to order that song. So it's a nice way to convey information in a not in a secure way, but in a trustworthy way. If you're both parties are trying to cooperate in this transaction. And watermarking can be content specific. It's hardest when the bandwidth is low. So text, it's really hard to do watermarking in anything like a credible way. They do all kinds of crazy things. They'll do custom font spacing. They'll change the font a little bit, like the Bacon cipher, which I guess we didn't talk about. But they you don't have very many opportunities to hide bits in text. In music, it's a little bit easier. You can Fourier transform and do something in the frequency spectrum and perturb things a little bit, change the average of some things. Most of those watermarks can be eliminated by a guy who knows how you've done it. And again, you have to tell everybody how you've done it, otherwise you can't know how to write the detector. Picture video is even easier to watermark. Okay. I just told you how watermarking systems are broken. I guess this was my funny, how do you actually defeat a system like this? And it's kind of don't ask, don't tell, don't enforce. Just run an application that doesn't look for the watermark, and you're in good shape. In fact, it's an interesting application. The guys are cooperating with the industry, trying to enforce the watermark at a positive disadvantage to the guys who say, I'm not going to look for that thing. Why would I, and the users who are buying the software have no godly interest in buying the software which is going to look for the watermark. They want the stuff that's not going to look for the watermark. So it's a crazy business model I never quite understood. The ARM systems, despite that, you still see some, and many people do like wacky, stupid things. Because they're in software and not hardware, people will try to protect them in bizarre ways. They'll try to detect debuggers. They'll try to detect changes in the system. And the big question is, what do you do when somebody's trying to... You detect something which you think is an attack on the DRM system. Well, one thing you could just do is just shut up and go home, which is a good thing to do. But somebody whose name begins with S and has four letters and is near the bottom of the list decided they were going to ruin your machine if they detected some stuff. And so there's lots of... if you do software protection, you're at risk, and you're tempted to try to protect yourselves in ways you wish you wouldn't have later. So
I had to clean that stuff off of my machine.
It was terrible.
Really angry.
It was a really bad idea. Everybody I know, when they heard this, they said, oh, no. This was kind of like Nixon and the Watergate tapes. You could think whatever, however badly you thought of Nixon, but when you heard this, he can't possibly have done that. And then there's all kinds of, there's all this politics. Is, do we want a weak DRM system so nobody argues about it too much? Do we want a relatively strong DRM system? It's a little bit of a political morass there. The biggest problem in DRM systems for a big DRM, the stuff I call big DRM, is what I call the Bobby attack. I think I coined this. Well, this Yakov did Bobby. I did Bohr. No, he did Bohr. I did Bobby. Yeah. Break once, break everywhere. And there are almost always mechanisms where you can devise a thing which breaks the player, and once you've broken a player, you can distribute that break to everybody in the universe. You can just say, here's a little DLL, attach it to your trusted program, it'll make your trusted program work for you, not the guy trying to protect this content. And they're easy to do in general. No matter what you do, in classic machines now, without hardware, you can't really, there's the transducer problem. This is even, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do security. If you're working for the government, you give people security clearances. They see classified information. There's nothing in the world, aside from throwing in jail, that you can do to prevent them from remembering what they read and going to tell somebody afterwards. They left your building. They're going to tell somebody what they did. So the only thing you can do is punish them. So that's the transducer problem. If you play music and it's protected, you can put a microphone up to it and tape it. And if you distribute it to a broad enough set of people, somebody's going to do that. It's really hard to isolate I/O on classic devices also. The frame buffers in these machines are pretty much any software can grab the frame buffer. Although we're changing, that's being changed. It's an issue. There are privacy and interoperability concerns. Again, I said it was nice and easy to license content. I handed you a license which had an identifier that said what my machine is. You can find out who I am. So there are ways to get around that. There are anonymous ways to authenticate yourself. But again, it introduces issues. Josh may not want me to know that he watches 101 Dalmatians when he's 20.
That's not so bad.
Yeah. So you got to watch that. On the other hand, there are some opportunities. Again, if you do it stupid, like you can only use this thing on one device, and if that device is broken, tough bunnies, got to go out and buy all your movies all over again, or CDs, or whatever the hell it is you protected. You can actually, since it's software, you can actually do a good job for people, and whatever device they have, it can run on well. So there are opportunities to do DRM well and do a good job for people, not make it terrible for them, make it actually a better experience than the real copy. But anyway, there are tons and tons of social policies. The one represented is this fair use. In copyright law, one of the defenses, a major defense actually, that that you can bring up. Somebody sues you for copyright defense, so one of the first things you say is fair use. I just copied a little section of this. It was for my personal use, blah, 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 blah. That doctrine is called fair use, and it's a defense against somebody coming to you to sue you for copyright infringement, or for that matter, accusing you of federal, you know, copyright violation, the criminal offense. Now be careful, there are limits to fair use. If you sell it commercially after you copied it, don't go saying fair use, that's not going to work. And there are all kinds of complicated rules about that are used as guides to determine whether it's really fair use or not. Like, for example, if you copy a huge portion of a book, even if it's their personal use, people are not going to find fair use in that typically. And again, if it's your personal use, there's only so much damage you've done, you're just barred them from getting one copy. If you start distributing stuff, you're really in trouble. But fair use is a policy which was meant to arbitrate between the rights of the publishers, who want nobody to have any rights except for that what they pay for, right through the nose, and users, who by contrast would like everything to be free no matter how much it costs to produce. So fair use is one of the mechanisms. It's also, you know, again, for news stories, for political commentary, for scientific research, it's actually quite useful to have a limited exemption to say, look, Josh said this at this time, and I want to tell you that because it's important that Josh said it and wrote it down. He may have the copyright in the whole work, but it may be important that a portion of that I can tell you he said in this document. So there are lots of good reasons for fair use. My friend in Cambridge, Ross Anderson, always talks about monopoly lock-in. DRM is supposed to be good for monopoly lock-in. That, you know, if you're the dominant supplier in an industry, you can have a rights management system. And the theory is that everybody will use your rights management system and not anybody else's, and then you'll lock in, you'll leverage more and more stuff, which I always thought was stupid. If I was a content producer, I want to be as promiscuous as possible. I want everybody to have a rights management system that I can use because I want my content distributed. Anyway, that's the story. The trusted applications implement a contract, a policy, rather than appealing to the copyright law as the protection mechanism. So there's a worry, and I think this is a real worry that public policymakers will have to consider. There's a worry that a very dominant content supplier would impose overly draconian restrictions on how you can use content. So that's a worry for people. Archiving can sometimes cause a problem, but that's usually a problem because you designed the DRM system stupidly rather than you shouldn't be able to do it. There's a law which is very controversial called the DMCA law, which makes it a crime not to copy stuff, but to try to circumvent technical protection mechanisms. And many people don't think that's such a red hot idea. There's the argument that information wants to be free and nobody should charge for anything anyway. So for copyright, and there's some theories advanced around that.
That's the whole idea of copyright also. That eventually the information will be free.
Copyright law has gotten less and less like that. You know, the original copyright law was for 14 years. Then it was 28 years. Now it's 50 years, 100 years with the death. 75 plus the death from the death of the author. No, it's gotten worse and worse. How much?
It's 99 years now since the Seni Bono Act.
So is that 99 for an anonymous work, for a corporate work, or is it for, you know, by a personal author?
It's 95.
It's for Disney.
It's for Disney. Yeah. Actually, I was about to say, but I didn't say the D word. But I think the first extension of the law, I'm sorry, the most recent extension of the law was to, it was argued because some famous character with ears would go out of copyright or something.
By the way, Lawrence Lessig has a lot of really interesting thoughts on this issue.
Yeah. I think actually it's quite important. The public domain is pretty important, and it's important that stuff get to the public domain and not be draconian. On the other hand, people producing content, you know, they don't produce it solely out of a sense of altruism. So
sure.
And we, of course, I actually don't think this is a big deal for the following. The thing you need to watch out for is draconian licensing policies. The interesting thing is almost all companies that make a lot of money are in countries with governments. And the last thing a company wants is a law that says stop doing that to a company. Companies pretty much, big companies have to obey the law because they have lots of attackable assets. It's still something to worry about, political control over institutions, but that's another issue. Here's the classic, here's the classic attack on the DRM system.
This is the transducer problem?
You take the monitor with the protected content, you stick it on a photocopy machine.
The ultimate screen scrape.
Yeah, this ultimate screen scrape. So, that's DRM. I've talked about it in terms of content. I think it's a very general mechanism for doing distributed security. And it has several properties that we need in today's world. The most important of which is I can authenticate your code, and I can authenticate what affects the security of the thing I'm about to convey. And in today's world with viruses and people mismanaging their machines, that's actually quite an important feature. The other important feature is it fail-safe. I can give you all the stuff you need to know to make a security decision. I can't mess with it. I can facilitate the decision. And if you're missing any piece, the worst thing that happens is you don't get the stuff. The access decision is, access is denied. With most security mechanisms, most classic ones, we're always trying to argue with the too safe, too little. You're always making some kind of crazy compromise that's hard to track down. And as systems get more distributed and more complicated, it's important to have a really simple system, because security is tough. And if you have to think too hard about when something's safe, you're in trouble. It's just some wacky side condition is going to hurt you. So you
John?
Want to keep it as simple as possible. Yes?
Can you use this to find out if there's a keystroke logger on the Internet Cafe computer that you're about to log in on?
It depends. Actually, the hardware I told you about actually can prevent key logging, both certainly software key logging, and if you get a little fancier, it can even protect hardware key logging. And the mechanism for protecting hardware key logging is the computer will open up a secure channel to the keyboard. The keyboard will have a smart card, a public-private key pair, and the key logger will never see anything except encrypted traffic. So you can use this mechanism to protect against that sort of stuff, too. The other thing you can do, again, to get a little bit fancier, is if you're using a kiosk with this hardware in a public airport, you can carry around a small device, plug it into the USB thing, which will authenticate that it's running the operating system you expect, will authenticate the channel to you is safe. And again, you can get your stuff at that kiosk, pull out this authenticating token, and it not be available anyway else, just encrypted. So there are actually lots of good applications of this kind of hardware, which doesn't have anything to do with Disney or Mickey Mouse or any of those guys. Any other questions about DRM? I haven't mentioned crypto too much in this talk, but in fact, without public key crypto, this would actually literally be impossible. And I think most people will find as you do distributed security, despite the fact that you only have to use public key crypto relatively rarely, it's the thing which actually enables you to make a trust connection with somebody you've never seen before, to share keys. And then, again, the symmetric key crypto for confidentiality and the hash stuff for integrity, they're three very, very, very simple mechanisms which you should incorporate in equally simple mechanisms to protect people's security, but they're easy to understand. They're nice and contained. And without that, I think distributed security would be impossible. In fact, I think even distributed security in my house would be impossible without that.
Quick housekeeping.